From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I was a graduate assistant soccer coach at St. John's University in New York, where I publicly took issue with the fact that the university was accepting funds from the Nike Corporation. These are profits that are made on the backs of the poor. Because of the fact that I took issue with this, I was eventually given an ultimatum to wear the equipment, drop this issue, or resign.
We'll talk to a soccer coach who just said no to Nike. We'll find out what happened. And we go to Paris after the U.S.-British airstrikes against Iraq. Where does that leave Europe? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A leading U.S. Arab group called on the U.S. military to discipline soldiers who scrawled disparaging graffiti on missiles dropped on Iraq during Operation Desert Fox. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee called for an investigation into the incident, alleging it was indicative of widespread anti-Arab bigotry in the U.S. armed forces. The slogans such as "Die, you maggots," "This is going to hurt," and "To Saddam, Merry Christmas," along with "A present for Ramadan," were evidence, quote, of a culture of racism in the military towards Arab, this the committee said in a statement. It lambasted the Pentagon's failure to launch an inquiry into the incident and called for a thorough investigation and a program of sensitivity training for military personnel. In a statement issued by the Pentagon repudiated the graffiti, saying it was thoughtless and unrepresentative of U.S. soldiers. The ADC also said the incident was a corollary of the anti-Arab bias in U.S. foreign policy and attitudes which demonize and dehumanize Arabs in general and Iraqis in particular. These attitudes, it charged, were the bedrock of U.S. policy towards Iraq, leading to, quote, repeated unjustified bombings of Iraq and the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis because of economic sanctions. A U.S. Marine was killed and three were injured while training south of the Iraqi border 2 days after the end of U.S.-led strikes, this according to a U.S. military statement. It said the accident happened on Tuesday when a tactical vehicle overturned while training in Southwest Asia. The four Marines were taken to a hospital in Kuwait where one of them was pronounced dead. U.S. military sources said they were attached to the 31st Marine Expeditionary Unit. Vice President Al Gore says don't expect any admission of guilt from his boss. Gore tells CNN Clinton won't admit to perjury as part of any censure deal to avoid conviction in a Senate impeachment trial. The vice president says the president has acknowledged he misled interrogators in the Monica Lewinsky investigation, but that he did not lie under oath. Gore also says he and the president will not be buttonholing senators. He says that's not something that feels like it's appropriate in this situation. Meantime, key Senate leaders acknowledge that talks on the president's fate are underway among members of both parties. Clinton has been impeached by the House on charges of lying to a federal grand jury and obstructing justice in a cover-up and faces a trial in the Senate. United States is ordering three Cuban diplomats at the United Nations to leave the country for allegedly running a spy ring in Florida. The three diplomats were given until next week to pack their bags after the FBI found they were allegedly connected to a network of Cuban spies uncovered in Florida. There's no known precedent of a Cuban spy network being dismantled in the United States. The case exploded on September 13th when 10 people were arrested in Florida and accused of spying on U.S. military bases and Cuban exile groups for Cuba's government. It was the largest known roundup of accused agents from Havana since President Fidel Castro's 1959 revolution. State Department spokesperson James Rubin said the three Cuban diplomats were told to depart for activities incompatible with their status as members of the UN mission. A U.S. diplomatic source in New York said the three Cuban diplomats were given until Monday to leave the U.S. He made no mention of the countless destabilization efforts or assassination attempts against Fidel Castro carried out by U.S. federal agencies in Cuba. A woman whose boyfriend is accused of killing the gay University of Wyoming student has pleaded guilty to being an accessory after the fact to first-degree murder. Attorneys say 20-year-old Chastity Vera Pasley did not plead guilty as part of a plea bargain, and she will be called as a witness if the case against the other defendants goes on trial. Pasley is one of two women accused of helping Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson dispose of bloody clothing Henderson wore during the October 7th attack on 21-year-old Matthew Shepard. Shepard was beaten to death, and left to die on a fence near Laramie, Wyoming, attracting national attention to the ongoing violence committed against gays and lesbians in the United States. McKinney and Henderson have both pleaded innocent to the killing. A British court has ruled that former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet could leave his residence outside London, where he's under police guard, if he needs to see a doctor or dentist. London magistrate Graham Parkinson said it would be up to the senior police officer guarding Pinochet to decide how many people could accompany him to a hospital or clinic or visit him there if such a situation arose. Parkinson agreed to change the conditions of Pinochet's bail at the request of his lawyer, who said Pinochet had recently suffered from a dental problem. Lawyer Michael Kaplan said the request was purely precautionary, saying there's been no suggestion the general has wanted to go to the hospital. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S.-led bombing of Iraq last week was criticized heavily by a number of European powers who saw the four-day barrage as a unilateral act that ignored the position of the world community. Russia responded first by pulling its ambassador to Washington in protest. After the bombing stopped, Russia's defense minister called on the armed forces of the former Soviet states to cooperate more closely because, quote, the United States had become unpredictable. This is Russian Prime Minister Yevgeny Primakov said he favored a strategic triangle involving China, India, and Russia to ensure regional geopolitical stability during a recent summit in New Delhi. China eventually rejected the idea, but that it was raised in the first place points to Russia's discomfort with Washington's unilateralism in geostrategic affairs. Another vocal critic of the U.S. bombing was France. While the U.N. Security Council discussed the future of the sanctions against Iraq, a former French defense minister accused Washington of humiliating U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan by attacking Iraq without U.N. approval. Paul Quils, a member of the National Assembly's Defense Committee, wrote in the daily paper Liberation that the credibility of Annan and the U.N. Security Council were badly damaged by the bombings. He added, perhaps this was one of the indirect aims of the unilateral decision to bomb Iraq. What do these developments tell us about the relationship between the United States and Europe? How is Russia's response going to affect its relationship with NATO? And what role is Britain playing as Europe comes closer to monetary and political unity? Some of the issues we'll take on right now with Danielle Singer. Danielle Singer is the European correspondent for The Nation magazine and joins us from Paris. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Danielle.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, it's good to be with you. Why don't you talk a little about what the reaction is to this past week in the United States and Iraq?
I suppose that what we are discovering, you can say with Christopher Columbus is rather late, it's living with one superpower. You see, what shocked people, I think, in Europe to a large extent is the way in which the whole thing was done, because on one side, one had the impression that there was no purpose in the American action because, what, punishing obviously not Saddam but the Iraqi people, that it was a policy without a purpose. And at the same time, what it was obvious to anyone in Europe, I think, was that here you had this sort of self-appointed sheriff running the show with, you've mentioned that, with one close ally, that is to say Britain, but on everybody else was rather taken aback by this. What was striking, obviously, was the Russian reaction, because when we're talking about the world with one superpower, that means that the other superpower which has disappeared, that was the Soviet Union, you see. Now, Russia did react quite strongly, and I'm quite sure that this has strengthened the position of Primakov, the new prime minister. But at the same time, it revealed that it no longer can play the part that it did play before. It is no longer the other nuclear power that, I mean, it is still a nuclear power, but it's no longer that other superpower that can put a certain veto or a certain limit on American action. See, so that was one. And that's why all these attempts to talk with China and India on one side, to look at Western Europe on the other on behalf of the Russians. So that was one reaction. The other thing I think that was even more striking in Western Europe was the contrast between the alleged growing economic power of Western Europe. After all, we're on the eve of the euro, of the common currency, which is considered as a potential rival and competitor of the dollar, and so on and so on. And the weakness of the of Europe as a the diplomatic or foreign policy weakness, as a political weakness of Western Europe. That is to say, you had the reactions, if we accept Britain, the reactions at the governmental level and certainly at the level of public opinion, of newspapers and so on, were very negative. But you didn't have a combined joint action by the Europeans. One could take in advance the fact that Tony Blair would be sort of the puppy, the poodle of the United States. That has been accepted now, that the British government is that. Strangely enough, because 2 weeks before, Tony Blair was discussing with Jospin, with the French Prime Minister, about a new European defense policy and so on and so on. But in any case, you can put aside Britain, because one knew that Britain would align itself on the United States. But there was discontent everywhere else in Western Europe, and it did not express itself in a combined policy stand, which would say, we just disagree with you. Now, whether it will take that form at some later stage, that we shall see. But for the time being, there is this striking contrast between the economic power of Europe and its political weakness.
Danielle Singer is the correspondent for The Nation magazine in Europe, based in Paris. What about what Moscow is talking about right now with possibly more centrally coordinating the previous states of the USSR in reaction to this?
I don't think that would go very, very far. What would be more interesting, I think, would be an attempt by the Russians to coordinate its policy with Western Europe. That is to say, to make an attempt to have a new stand, a new alliance. I mean, the difficulty in that, and the real difficulty in the whole Russian position as a rival or a balance towards the United States, is that it's in an economic position where it is completely dependent, where it is asking for the aid from the International Monetary Fund, and everybody knows that aid of the International Monetary Fund depends very much on the attitude of the United States. That's what makes the whole position of Russia less potentially effective than it would have been otherwise. And that is why I think it depends so much now on Western Europe and on its capacity to say, I mean, the real issue now is sanctions and the embargo. I mean, the two things. If the West European countries took a stand, I mean, there are obvious differences in the Security Council between the United States and Britain on one side and all the others. Somebody took a stand saying, look, if it goes on like that, we're going to break the sanctions. If the Russians did that, if the West Europeans followed, this would create a completely new situation. But to create that situation, you would have to have a Western Europe that is willing to have an independent and coherent foreign policy of its own, which it hasn't got for the moment.
Danielle Singer, can you explain a little more this letter that Paul, is it Quiles, wrote, member of the National Assembly's Defense Committee, to Liberacion?
Yes, no, but look, in general, everybody takes it here for granted that this was a sort of, since nobody really knows what was the actual purpose of this bombing, was it to reassure the Israelis? It clearly was not to bring down Saddam, because one knew in advance. I mean, one doesn't assume that the Americans were stupid enough to believe that this bombing would bring him down. On the contrary, it strengthened his hand. So there was this obvious thing that one could see, which was the relationship with the Security Council. What was shocking here, and that's why so many people in France, in Italy, in Germany, were beginning to think that this is done for the purpose of helping President Clinton in his troubles with impeachment. What was so extraordinary looking at it from Europe was to see Why is it done? What was the purpose of it? And the way, the arrogant way in which the Security Council was completely bypassed. The rumors that one heard here all the time about the fact that that Anscombe was being used by the Americans directly, that Mr. Butler was reporting directly to the United States before reporting to the Security Council, that the Security Council was bypassed, and all that was so obvious from outside that one sometimes wondered whether the Americans were not doing that on purpose to reaffirm their position as the sheriff, as the superpower, as the one which can run the world affairs as it decides to do so, without any consideration for its potential allies.
I'm looking at the front page of the Christian Science Monitor today, and it's a piece by Jonathan Landy that says 70 hours after American and British airstrikes have thrown into disarray the 8-year effort to rid Iraq of its chemical, biological, and nuclear warfare program, the raids have intensified a dispute in the UN Security Council over the inspection regime as well as the economic sanctions, and it goes on to talk about all of that. What about the way people in France and Europe look at the UN versus the way people in the United States do? Because as we were saying, this might well have been also the reason Clinton did this was to look strong, not only in the face of Iraq, but in the face of the United Nations. It sort of curries favor, particularly with the Republicans.
Yeah. Now, the puzzling thing is what is going to be the next stage in that policy. And that's why you hear more and more voices. You had the French president suggesting that there should be a new policy. Everybody assumes that you can't now go back exactly to the policy that you had beforehand. So what one doesn't know is what will the United States do in reaction to that? That is to say, will they accept that at this stage one should have a different kind of inspection, something that which is closer to the Atomic Energy Commission or something like that, that would be just making from time to time certain inspections, but would not have this sort of regular system as it was up to now, and essentially that there would be signs that that Iraq will, or the Iraqi people will, feel some improvement. And some immediate improvement as a result of that. That is to say that you will have very rapidly some movement on sanctions and on the embargo, that the Iraqis should be able to sell more petrol, and that the Iraqi people should get better conditions, you see, because what it is so obvious in this, that this war was not a war against Saddam, whatever one proclaimed, it was a war against the Iraqi people, you see. What is shocking from I don't know whether it shocks people in the United States in the same way, is the hypocrisy of the whole thing. When you hear people in your establishment now saying, look, this man, we all know what kind of a man Saddam is, but when they are quoting now as an example the fact that he was using gas against his own people, against the Kurds actually, at the time when it happened, we on the left, we were saying that Saddam is a scoundrel. And at that time, the very same people who are using this argument are saying, oh, yes, yes, but we should be careful because he's against Iran and Iran is our enemy at the moment and so on.
You know, it's also important to note, you can't see this, Danielle Singer, but in the United States on television, the people almost the most often interviewed are people like Lawrence Eagleburger, people like Brent Scowcroft. And these were the very ones working with President Bush to ensure the relationship with Saddam Hussein.
Exactly. So, you know, there is this complete hypocrisy on the subject, which I think people in Europe are more aware of that, you see. Now, this is not at all a question of defending Saddam or of making out of Saddam a hero. What one has to show quite clearly that the purpose of the operation, even of bringing down Saddam, is not to replace him with some democratic ruler. You don't defend democracy when you have the Saudis as your allies. I mean, if it was the only reason that you attack countries, it's because they don't have democracy. You see, there are very many Middle Eastern countries that the United States would have to attack. It's so obvious that this is pure propaganda, But it's not only pure propaganda, but at the same time, it's bypassing the Security Council, having a completely contemptuous attitude towards the United Nations. And all that, you see, is provoking this discontent, disenchantment, criticism, and so on in Europe. Yet at the same time, there is no real European policy to oppose it. And there is no real European policy because there is no European state, there is no European, there is no different society in Europe to which would say we are different from the Americans on that stage because we are acting and thinking of a different society. And that is why I would link it with the euro. You see, that even when one thinks that at this stage Europe is moving towards some kind of unity, financial unity, it will not stand up to the United States. It will not have a real impact on world policy unless it has the vision of a different society, and that is something that is at stake in the in what is happening in Europe now and what will be happening in the next few months.
Danielle Singer, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Danielle Singer, European correspondent for The Nation magazine, speaking to us from Paris, France. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll find out what happened to a coach who just said no to Nike. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On Tuesday, the transnational shoe and apparel maker Nike announced it's reducing payments to the National Basketball Association and withholding payments to teams and players due to the prolonged NBA work lockout. The Beaverton, Oregon-based company says the move is part of a contingency plan to deal with the NBA's six-month labor dispute, which they claim has hurt demand for Nike products. What they failed to point out in their announcement is that Nike's slump in sales may be attributable to its stained image in the United States and abroad, an image fostered by its use of sweatshop labor in Asia and Latin America. Today, we're going to bring you two compelling stories related to Nike. On this Christmas Eve, thousands of shoppers will probably be buying Nike products to leave under the tree tomorrow morning. For this occasion, we thought it would be interesting to see how people are taking a stand against the unjust labor practices being carried out by such a major U.S. corporation like Nike. I should say we did invite Nike to join us, and we didn't get calls back by the end of the working day yesterday. We're even waiting to see now if we'll get a call as we speak. We're first joined by Jim Keady. He's a former assistant coach for St. John's University men's soccer team, which was one of the top-ranked NCAA Division I soccer teams in the country. Jim's also working on his master's in pastoral theology at St. John's. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Good morning.
Well, it's nice to be with you. What do you have to do with Nike?
Well, it's interesting how this all happened. I was, as you said, I'm studying for a degree in pastoral theology, and I was taking a course in moral theology, and my professor made the suggestion that I try to find some topic for a research paper to link moral theology and sports. And after knocking around a number of issues, I happened to read in one of the major New York publications something about Nike and their labor practices. A few days later, I happened to notice in one of the publications of St. John's University that a graduate student, a fellow graduate student in the theology program, had written an editorial just generally addressing this issue. You know, he had known that the university was beginning dealings with Nike, and he just brought up the question, is this something we need to take a look at? At that point, I found the topic for my research paper, and after doing maybe about 3 weeks' worth of research, another letter came out in response to this graduate student's editorial from athletic director Ed Mineta. And his comments were exonerating Nike and their labor practices and the university's relationship with Nike. Now, I'd only done 3 weeks or so worth of research, and I could already tell by that in no way could Nike's labor practices fit within the mission of St. John's University, which I believe should show a consistent option for the poor. We need to support the poor.
St. John's a Catholic university.
Yes, it's actually the largest Catholic university in the United States. So I just wanted to write a response to Mr. Mineta's letter. So I took about a week or so, thought out a response, gave it to my head coach, Dave Mazur, and I said, Dave, listen, I'm interested in responding to Mr. Mineta's letter. I don't want this coming out of left field. I don't want you to get upset. Here, take a look. Dave read it. He said, you know, it sounds good to me. I don't necessarily agree with you, but if, you know, you want to do this, fine. Now, I knew Dave was then going to bring it upstairs to Ed, which he did. And later that afternoon, I met with Mr. Mineta. And he said to me, look, your letter's well written. You know, I can appreciate your opinion. I don't necessarily agree with it. If this is something you feel like you have to do, fine, no problem. My letter never made it into the publication, into St. John's Today, which is the official publication of St. John's University. I've later been told at a forum on free speech at the university. I was later told by the editor of this paper that he just couldn't recall how my letter didn't make it in. When he first spoke to me about it, he had said that this was a dead issue. And I questioned him. I said, a dead issue? It's in every major newspaper in the country about Nike's labor practice. How can it be a dead issue at St. John's University, especially when we're negotiating a $3.5 million contract with them? And he didn't really have an answer for me. Following that, it's really interesting how things fell out. I find out my letter's not going to get into the paper. That morning, the now editor of the student newspaper, The Torch, called me. And he had heard that I was doing some research and asking some questions and running into some problems. And he said, listen, you know, we'd like to do a story. And I said, fine. I said, I just found out from St. John's Today that they don't want to run my editorial. I'll speak to you today, this afternoon. Meet me at study hall. I used to run study hall for the guys on the team. And at about 4 o'clock, before this reporter showed up, Dave Mazur, the head coach, came to study hall and handed me a letter that said something to the effect that my actions were demonstrative, that I was publicly ridiculing St. John's University. Now, to this point, I had done nothing publicly, and basically that I shouldn't be speaking to the newspapers. And I said, Dave, you know, be very careful where this conversation's going. You're about to tread on my First Amendment rights. And he just didn't seem to grasp it. He said, listen, if you're working for a major company, you're working for IBM or some other multinational, and you come out publicly, you're going to get fired. And I said, Dave, this isn't a multinational corporation. This is a university, a Catholic university, which should be a zone for academic freedom. I should be allowed to speak my mind. Well, as Dave and I are getting into it in the hallway, the reporter happens to walk by, as well as my theology professor who had told me to look into this topic. And after Dave left, the reporter came over. He's like, look, I saw what happened. You know, do you still want to talk to us? And I said, you know, can I speak to Father Paul Sirlis, who is my professor? So can I speak to him for a few minutes? And he says, yeah, sure, okay. So I said, what do you think? And Paul said, well, what do you think? I said, I'd like to play by their rules because I think this is going to get bigger and I don't want to set myself up for a major problem early on. So he said, you know what, I'll give the interview, because he would basically say the same thing that I was going to say. So he did, and it hit the front page of the student newspaper on February 11th, I believe. And I came into the office the next day, and you would have thought that I dropped a bomb on the athletic department. And my name was nowhere near this article. I come into the office, I have Dave screaming at me, I have one of the other assistant coaches screaming at me, the athletic director had already been down talking to them.
And the article in the Torch in the student newspaper basically said...
It questioned the university's relationship, that should we, as a Catholic university, be accepting profits or be accepting funding from a company who makes their profits on the backs of the poor.
Well, let's just explain that for a minute, because this is going on at hundreds of universities around the country, colleges and even high schools.
Okay, but that over 200.
That Nike was in the process of negotiating this deal, as you said, with St. John's to give them $3.5 million.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was told off the record when I was just doing a research paper. And I didn't know that this would lead to any sort of activism. I was just looking for a good paper topic. And I was told by an assistant athletic director that, yeah, it'd be around $3.5 million, $500,000 in product and money and stipend over 7 years.
$500,000. When you say in product, that means in equipment and clothes, sneakers.
Top to bottom, sneakers, socks, shorts, T-shirts, sweats, unit balls, whatever they need.
So there you were in the face of the anger of your coach, and you're an assistant coach as well.
Yes.
And some other coaches, and you're sitting there with the front page article of The Torch that only quotes your professor.
Yeah, I was not quoted at all. And I was taken back. I said, Dave, listen, I did what you told me to. I didn't say a word. I can't help it if a professor wants to give an interview. And they just didn't seem to buy it. So things moved forward, and I was told the whole time when I'm doing this research, I'm told, you have to go see Sister Margaret John Kelly. She'll have the answer for you. Go see Sister Margaret John. Go see Sister Margaret John. So finally the article comes out, and I say, okay, I'll go see Sister Margaret John Kelly to make you happy. And Sister Margaret John Kelly at the time, she's now the dean of the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. At the time, she was the head of the Church and Society. It's a special office of the president that would deal with issues like this. So I went to meet with her, brought all my research, and I said, Sister, you know, I want to be wrong on this. I want you to tell me something that maybe show me something I've missed so my conscience can rest easy in wearing this equipment and in the fact that the university is accepting funds from this company. And as we began to talk, I began to realize that she really hadn't done much research on this at all. I said, you know, what have we based our decision on? How are we exonerating our own position and Nike's practices? And she said, well, we've looked into the Andrew Young study that was done and the Dartmouth Tuck School of Business study.
And let's be clear, Andrew Young was employed by Nike to do a report on its sweatshops in places like Indonesia. And when he came back, he gave the report directly to Nike, kept it secret for a long time, and then held a news conference.
Yeah, so I said, Sister, you know, I have copies of both of those with me. I've read them, I've scrutinized them. I said, I'm no economist by any stretch, but I've found some flaws in their methodology, in their findings, and their conclusions. I said, can I see your copies? And maybe you can show me what I've missed, you know, where you think everything's okay. And her reply was, oh, well, I've never read them. And I was shocked. I said, you never read them? You've just told me that this is what we've based our decision on. She said, well, I read a couple articles about them. So at that point, I got a sense that the university had simply entered into this relationship for the money, hadn't done any research, any significant research, on this company's labor practices. And
what had you understood the labor practices to be? What do you understand them to be?
There's just a general exploitation of the workers. Multinational corporations search the globe for the lowest wage level that they can. I mean, in the economic equation, and everything gets commodified, including labor. So you have companies that'll search through Southeast Asia, through Latin America, for the cheapest wage level, and then take advantage of the fact. And I don't believe that Nike has entered into these countries for their economic development. They see that a great advantage can be gained in maximizing their profit. And there's specific teaching within the church. There's a body of teaching called Catholic social teaching. It started with an encyclical called Rerum Novarum. It's about 100 years worth of teaching that speaks to these issues. And in studying these encyclicals, 100 years worth of encyclicals, on the social question, I came to realize that there's no way that Nike's labor practices can fit within the parameters of Catholic social teaching. And I took issue with that. I don't think they can fit within the parameters of the mission of the university, which I think wouldn't include this the spirit of Catholic social teaching.
Now, with St. John's signing off on this $3.5 million contract with Nike, what did it mean you'd have to do as an assistant coach?
It was somewhat ironic that while I was beginning to publicly take issue with this, I still had to do my job as an assistant coach. So I was on the phone with Nike constantly. I was ordering the equipment. I was working with the people who run their play programs, getting things lined up for next year. As a coach, I would have had to have worn the equipment, shoes, socks, sweats, T-shirts, everything.
What if you didn't?
Well, if I didn't, I was eventually told that I would have to wear it or resign.
You'd have to wear Nike clothes or resign?
Or resign, yes. It came to a point because of the controversy that surrounded this issue, and because it was the belief that I was at the center of the controversy, which I guess I was, I will attest to that, that if I didn't wear the equipment, that would be a public statement in itself, and that the head coach, Dave, felt he couldn't have any of this because it was taking away from his program. And in a sense, I can appreciate that, but I felt the administration of the university should have said to Dave, Dave, listen, this is, you know, a matter of conscience that Jim's struggling with. And there's very specific teaching about following your conscience within the body, moral theology. And I don't think the university administration supported my decision of conscience to the point where I could have continued on as a coach and not worn the equipment.
What did the soccer players feel?
The guys are torn. They're in a difficult spot. I mean, you have players. We have a number of potential professionals on the team. They just want to play and go to school. And to confront them with a social justice issue isn't something that they, you know, are necessarily ready for. Some of the guys have said, hey, you know, I think you're right, but there's no way I'd say it publicly because look what's happening to you. And I'm on scholarship. I need the scholarship. And I want to play. And I could appreciate that. I mean, this one player wrote a scathing letter to the president of the university, Father Harrington, and handed it to me to take a look at. And in one of the, at the bottom of the letter, it said something to the effect of, if this is what St. John's is about, they should take the crucifix off the library. There's a big crucifix on top of the library. And they should put the Nike swoosh up there. And I said to him, I said, this is great. Send it in. He said, what, are you crazy? He said, you know, I'm on scholarship. I don't want to lose my scholarship. And, I mean, they're in a tough spot. And I would say this issue is so multidimensional. They are being exploited. They're being turned into walking billboards. And I would say that in itself is a violation of their First Amendment rights. It's a coerced speech or a forced speech. And this is an issue that has yet to be. Actually, it was somewhat addressed by the president of the university in an article in Catholic News Services. He said the student-athletes are proud of wearing this equipment. And let's argue that, yeah, maybe they are. But if they are, there's something intrinsically wrong there. If at a Catholic university, our student-athletes are proud of representing a company that has grossly violated human and workers' rights for over 10 years, this has been a public issue, something is being lost in the educational equation there.
Well, I would like you to stay with us, Jim. Jim Keady, former assistant coach of St. John's University men's soccer team, which is one of the top-ranked NCAA Division I soccer teams in the country. Former assistant coach, and we'll find out what exactly led to the final break, what that was like. And then we're going to be joined by some local activists in New York, Leo Johnson, who is coordinator of the Edenwald Gun Hill Neighborhood Center based in the Bronx, along with Bryant Hernandez, who's 16 years old and one of the people who've been organizing in his community against Nike. And I also should say that we did try to get Father Harrington, who is the president of St. John's University. University, but the school is closed and we weren't able to reach him. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! On this Christmas Eve, and we'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with Jim Keady, former assistant coach for the St. John's University men's soccer team. And this team is very significant in the country, one of the top-ranked NCAA Division I soccer teams. As Jim was just saying, a lot of the guys who are on this team go on to play professional soccer. So, Jim, what happened? How, in the end, did you leave your position as an assistant coach?
Well, the issue became very public, and from what my professor has told me, he's been at St. John's for 23 years. He said he's never seen an issue get so much attention and generate so much interest in his 23 years at St. John's University. So we were on to something. Because of the turmoil it created within the soccer program, I mean, I'd be arguing with Dave on a weekly basis,
Dave Mazur, the head coach.
It eventually got to the point where Dave said, look, I need this issue sorted out. It has to end. And I call it D-Day. It happened on May 12th. It was such an interesting day. I was told the day before that the athletic director wanted to speak to me. And I went in the morning, and I went to the soccer office, and Dave and I started to talk about the issue. And it eventually came to the point where I said, Dave, look, you have your position, I have my position. I know you feel this is hurting the program, and I don't want to hurt the program. I respect Dave. He and I played professionally together for 3 years. He's one of the greatest motivators, and he's an incredible coach. And the program he's built at St. John's is just a testament to his hard work and commitment to the game. And as a player and a coach, I really appreciated that. But there are some more important things in life, and I felt this issue was one of them. So Dave says, look, this has to be stopped. It's taking away from your coaching ability, which I didn't feel it was doing, and I guess, you know, perception is reality. He perceived it as such. And he said, listen, you have to wear the equipment. You have to drop this issue. I said, well, Dave, what if I can't? What if I say to you, look, at the end of the day, on a matter of conscience, now, theologically speaking, your conscience is your connection to the divine. This is the God in me saying, look, you can't do this. I don't know if Dave completely grasped that, but he said, look, you can't wear the equipment. You don't drop this issue. You have to resign. And I said, can I have that in writing? He said, in writing? What do you want it in writing for? I said, well, if I'm going to go to another employer, I want to be able to show to them the reason why I resigned from this job. I said, it's just business, not personal. He said, no, I'm not giving it to you in writing. I'm telling you right now. You wear the equipment, you drop the issue, or resign. I said, okay. I said, can I have, you know, some time to think about it? And I still had to go up to speak to the athletic director. So I got the call from the AD secretary, and I shoot upstairs, and Ed Mineta, the athletic director, says, you know, what can we do for you? And I was taken back. I said, what can you do for me? I said, you're the one who called me in. And I'd actually spoken to another vice president at the university, and he had made some calls, and this is why I got called into to Ed's office. And Ed says, you know, look, this contract's probably going to go through. You've got a problem with it. You know, what's going to happen here? He said, if you didn't wear Nike, what would you wear?
And I was taken back because we'd never gotten to this point. And I, off the top of my head, I said, I don't know, maybe I wear just a generic sweatsuit. I get a gray sweatsuit, says St. John Soccer on it. You know, maybe during games I wear a shirt and tie like the basketball coaches do, which would have hindered my coaching responsibilities because I was responsible for getting the guys warmed up for the game. But I guess I could concede that for the issue. And he said, you know, well, we'll have to talk about that. And I left his office. Wow, we've made some progress. So I go back downstairs, and I share this with Dave, and Dave loses his mind. He says, look, I already told you. This issue needs to be dropped. He said, I can't have you running around. I need you to focus in on the program. And if you don't wear the equipment, that's a public statement in itself. And I can't have this issue revolving around my program anymore. So again, he said, you wear it, you drop the issue, or you resign. And actually, I believe this is when I asked, can I have that in writing? And emphatically said no. And I said, can I have 2 weeks to think about it? He said, 2 weeks? What do you need 2 weeks for? I said, well, Dave, this is a pretty big decision. I'm coaching one of the best soccer programs in the country, and I'm thinking about leaving it over a matter of conscience. I'd like some time to mull it over. So I said, all right, can I have a week? And he said, sure. So I leave that day, and this is the same day that Nike comes up with their new labor initiatives. And they're, you know, when I first heard the news, I was elated. I said, oh, this is great. I'm going to be able to stay on as a coach. Nike's going to do the right thing. I called Dave up. I said, hey, did you see the news? Nike's doing what we've been talking about. He said, look, send me a memo that says you're going to wear the equipment, drop the issue, and resign.
Or resign.
So I sent him up a fax the next day that had said, you know what, I feel comfortable wearing the equipment, but having just read the transcripts from the press conference, I said, I'm not sure how to drop this issue publicly because Nike still hasn't addressed the two most crucial issues, which is paying a living wage to their workers and allowing their workers the right to organize to collectively bargain for better working conditions. Said, so I gave him one of the two. So I still really hadn't conceded to what he'd asked me for. Then in the next week, I worked a soccer clinic and actually wore Nike gear. And one of my buddies said, hey, is that going to burn a hole in your chest? And I said, no, Nike's doing the right thing. They're moving forward. And he said, oh, yeah, you sold out the issue, huh? And that really hurt, especially from who said it. He's a good friend of mine. I really respect him. And then after continuing to read about the transcripts of the Nike's press conference, I just knew that this was all smoke. Nothing significant was happening. And then I went into the office about 2 weeks later, and Dave and I had another conversation, and it was over the fact that I asked him to put his ultimatum in writing. He said, you know, I was really hurt by that. A friend wouldn't do that. And I said, Dave wasn't a friend. We're friends, but it's business. It's not personal. And he said, the issue's going to be dropped, right? And I just kind of sat there and didn't say much. And I knew that day that I couldn't. My conscience would not let me drop this issue. I could not wear the equipment. And about 3 weeks later, I resigned.
Jim Keady, former assistant coach for the St. John's University men's soccer team, one of the top-ranked NCAA Division I soccer teams in the country, who couldn't just wear a sweatshirt that said St. John's Soccer, maybe even with a cross on it. That wasn't enough. There had to be a swoosh. Before we end today's show, we are joined by two other guests, and I want to include them in this conversation with Jim. Jim, by the way, what is your email address and also the president of St. John's University, Father Harrington?
My email address is jwkeady, K-E-A-D-Y, at AOL.com. And Father Harrington, who's the president of St. John's, his email address is presiden, drop the T off the end, at St. John's, all lowercase, no periods, no apostrophes, at stjohns.edu. And you can also call the university at 718-990-6161 and just ask to be transferred to Father Harrington's office, and you can let him know how you feel.
That's 718-990-6161. Again, we tried to get in touch with him, but the college is closed for the holiday. We are joined, as I said, also by Leo Johnson, coordinator of the Edenwald Gun Hill Neighborhood Center, which is in the Bronx, and Brian Hernandez, who is a 16-year-old who is working on the issue of Nike. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Let's start with Leo Johnson. What are you doing around Nike?
Well, We're constantly educating young people about Nike's overseas practices and about the things that they can do to make change. So that's what we're doing. We're just trying to remain consistent with that, and this is the way that we build strength and get young people out there to rally behind this very important issue.
Brian Hernandez, how did you get involved with it? Why does Nike matter to you?
Basically, I was just lounging around the community center, not basically knowing what to do with myself. About 4 years ago, I was probably like 12, 13, going on 13. And Mr. Johnson, you know, he hooked me up to this because I was looking at this. You know, I've never actually bought a pair of Nikes except for like maybe one pair, which was given to me as a gift. And my mother just refused to buy it. So Mr. Johnson was showing me all these newspaper articles about what they do across the globe. And I was like, whoa, this is some heavy stuff here. And he and Mr. Michael Gittleson, who now is a director someplace else, decided that they should form a campaign. And I was like, well, I'm good to go with it. And basically, you know, we noticed that a lot of the people who go to our community center, they wear Nikes. And I'm like, they all live in my neighborhood, and I know how my neighborhood is like. We're not like middle. I wouldn't even consider myself middle class because we're not. And how people can afford like $120 pair of sneakers. And I see them coming in with hardly like no clothes. Their clothes are like old, but they have brand new sneakers and they all Nikes. And I'm like, what? This is not right here. So, you know, we started a campaign and we kept it going and we're still here today.
What do you tell other young people? Nike's very important.
Nike's very important to them. And it's also very important to me too, because you know, we're trying to fight against them so they can change their practices across the globe. The thing is that when I talk to other youngs, like, I don't want to hear that, you know, man, this is the only stuff that looks good out there. I'm like, well, yeah, but check this out, yo. Your sneakers are $120 and they only made for $6. Aren't you getting gypped someplace along the line? And when they hear this, they're like, what? $6? What you talking about? I bought my stuff for like $120. It's like, yep, and you got gypped. So, you know, they're really pissed. And then I tell them about all the stuff that happens. Some people go for it and some people don't. You know, they're like, well, it ain't happening to me. So, you know, they can stay over there and work in 14 hours for whatever they want to work with. But I'm going to keep buying my sneakers. And some people are really pulled back by it. Like, really? Like, yo, I didn't know this, man. That's messed up. And then, you know, you kind of put them like on a guilt trip. That's what I try to do. I'll be like, well, what happened if your mother was working at one of these, or your father, your little brother, you know, what would you think about it now? He's like, well, they're not, so I don't really care. But it's a moral issue, you know. What they're doing in this country is illegal, but it's a moral issue, because how are you going to take advantage of people like this? And it's just not right. And, you know, it's like, and Mr. Johnson has told me time and time again, you go into a sneaker store and that's all that's there is Nikes, Nikes, Nikes. You know, there's hardly any Felis, hardly any Reeboks. He says it constantly. They're always taking away our power of choice. You know, we have nothing. We either choose Nike or we choose whatever's left behind in the little boxes and cargo holds, wherever it's at. You know, we're getting chipped all around.
So, Leo Johnson, what is this campaign that you're engaged in?
Okay, this campaign is a symbolic campaign. It's the Settlement House Youth Sneaker Give Back Campaign. And what we do is we go around the community centers, other groups and organizations, educate their young people about Nike's practices, educate young people about the things that they can do to make change. And every once in a while, we come up with fantastic ideas, like meeting in front of Nike Town. And having kids there from all over the city and returning sneakers. And the Nike Corporation, you know, is very uncomfortable when their customers, their number one customer, the young people, especially in the inner city, you know, it's the inner city youth who set the trends for the rest of the youth around the world. So, you know, the Nike Corporation is very uncomfortable when they see young people in front of Nike Town chanting in unity, many different colors. The ethnic barrier is wide, and, you know, and it's well organized, and it's hitting them right where it hurts. They're like, oh my God, you know, these people are not going to buy our product. If they don't buy our product, we're not going to be the entity that we are globally.
And how has Nike responded?
Well, Nike has visited the Eaton Wall Gun Hill Neighborhood Center September 10th, 1997, and it was an interesting meeting. They sent Veda Manager and Lincoln Parker to the Edenwall Gun Hill Neighborhood Center.
Veda Manager has been on Democracy Now! A few times, oh, spokesperson yeah. for Nike.
Hello, Veda. Okay. So anyway, you know, they visited us. We had a meeting. The meeting was very interesting. They tried to talk us out of educating young people about Nike's overseas practices. They told us that we were misinformed. There's no way you can be misinformed on this issue. There's been a consistency in the reporting for about 10 years. They tried to tell us that, oh, well, it's not what it seems. When we look into the type of reinvestment the Nike Corporation does, when you think about the $5 billion that they made in sneaker sales just in 1996, what percentage of that was reinvested into the community where young people kill for those sneakers? Okay, so there was nothing that they could really tell us.
Were you there at that meeting with Veda Manager, the Nike people, Bryant?
No, I didn't get to participate in that meeting.
Were other young people there?
We had young people there from other community centers, from Goddard Riverside. They had a couple young people there. We had a small contingency of people from the settlement houses. There were social workers.
Are you getting the sense, Leo, that this is happening around the country?
It is happening around the country. People are doing things against Nike everywhere. There are sit-ins. There are protests. We were going to do an East Coast, West Coast sneaker give back. We have people on the West Coast that are doing fantastic things, educating people about Nike. You know, I'm constantly out, you know, educating young people about Nike.
How can people get in touch with the Edenwall Gun Hill Neighborhood Center?
Well, the Edenwall Gun Hill Neighborhood Center's telephone number is 652-2232. If you want to
Is that 718?
718, mm-hmm. Yes, it is. If you'd like to contact me, you can use that number, but contact me in between 7 and 10 p.m.
That's Eastern Standard Time.
Yes, and if you'd like to fax me something, the number is 652-2501.
Again, the phone number, 718.
652-2232.
And I also want to get Jim Keedy again, your email address, if people want to get in touch with you.
JWKeedy, K-E-A-D-Y, @AOL.com.
And finally, let's end with Bryant. Okay, you're 16 years old. Christmas is tomorrow. And what are you telling people?
Don't buy the Nikes, okay? People, you got to understand that Nikes are not what you should buy. I mean, look at, what are you telling your kids? If you buy them a pair of Nikes, they're going to come to, let's say he passes by Edenwall, then we start talking about, my parents bought me a pair of sneakers that are made from some Asian woman who's working her butt off all over the 14 hours a day. I mean, wow, my parents really don't care about what happens. What kind of morals are my parents teaching me if they buy me a pair of Nikes that I can use people, I can pay them whatever they want, I can basically use them for legal slave labor, put it that way. You're paying them minimum wage, which is legal in these countries, but they can't live on minimum wage. I mean, what kind of stuff are you doing?
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us, especially on this day when those procrastinating last-minute shoppers are making some really life and death decisions. So thanks very much, Bryant Hernandez and Leo Johnson from the Edenwall Gun Hill neighborhood, and Jim Keedy. Thanks for being with us as well. I can say from St. John's University, because you're still a student there,
yes,
even if you're not an assistant soccer coach. If you'd like a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mario Murillo and Maria Carrion. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin's our executive producer. Our webmeister is Michelle Garcia. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
I'm Mark.